World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. The story now of an RAAF veteran who jumped from his crippled bomber and walked through the snows and forests of Germany before being captured. Norm Ginn was another country boy from a fruit block out of Mildura that his father had helped establish after migrating from England.
19 he came out from England, yes, and he came out to help his brother on the block just out of Mildura fruit block.
Right, okay. So you grew up on a fruit block?
Yes, I grew up on a fruit block, yes. And went to school there, went to central school in Mildura, and also the high school in Mildura.
And what about your own work? How old were you when you left school?
I was 15 and a half.
Right. Yeah. So what did you do? Go and work on the block? Or
yes,
what?
Well, first of all, I got a job in a garage and tried to get an apprenticeship, but by then the petrol ration was in, so I only lasted 18 months there. And then I had 6 months with another big garage, Stewart and Harrison's, and the same thing happened there. They were putting off people, so I finished up going back on the block with my father, so before I joined up.
You'd been an apprentice mechanic?
No, I couldn't get an apprenticeship because they were putting people off rather than taking people on because of the petrol, the lack of petrol, and cars weren't selling, and things were going bad at that time.
So what sort of work were you doing for these companies?
Well, I was helping with the chap that used to grease cars and things like that, and with Stewart and Harrison's. It was just staying up cars and cleaning them, getting ready to try and sell them. That was my job, just labouring jobs, really.
And then you enlisted 31st of January 1942.
Yeah. Well, when I joined up and was in the reserves, and I had to go to a high school a couple of nights a week for about 5 months before they called me up in December. And then they postponed that because of the Japanese.
Yes.
And then I was postponed again. Then finally I went in on the 31st of January.
So there you were in the Air Force.
Yes.
And this was your selection? You particularly wanted to serve?
Yes, I wanted to go into the Air Force, yes.
Good on you. What about training then? After enlistment, where did you go to train?
Well, first of all, we went to Summers.
Yep.
Where we did 3 months, all sorts of course, mathematics, different things like that, just schooling to get us up to that stage to be able to handle anything. It was just more or less selecting us to go into aircrew.
Yes.
And so most of us were made wireless operators because at that stage the Japanese had mucked up the air training scheme and was thought that we'd be crewing the American planes. So most of us were selected as wireless operators, gunners, and so forth. And in 3 months, I was passed out as a gunner, as a wireless operator. And I was then sent to Parkes, did a 6 month course at Parkes, flying training with Morse code and with the sets we had, learning to transmit Morse code and all that sort of thing. And so we did 6 months there and then did 3 months at Port Pirie Gunnery course.
Right. Yes. So pretty solid training?
Yes, they kept it going pretty thick. Yes, they were trying to push us through as fast as they could. we didn't get any much of a let up. So it was quite good though, but some found a Morse code very hard to learn, and they became gunners, a lot of them. But I liked it. When I was waiting to go into the Air Force, I did go to the post office and under the Air Force and sort of learned a bit of Morse code and tapping with the way they said telegrams and things like that.
What speed did you have to get to with
Morse? Well, we had to get to 18 per words per minute.
At sending?
Yeah, sending, yes. But it was a different type of Morse code to the post office, whereas at the post office, they read the gaps between the message where they're tapping, and whereas we were, that there was the Morse code was the sound of the Morse code.
Yes.
So we had to go change from tapping to sound, which is a different way of learning Morse code. But a good many of us passed out at there, and then when we passed out there, we were sent over to Port Pirie on ferry battles, and we'd retake it up and learn to fire at drones and things like that till we got sort of past our gunnery courses as a gunner, yeah.
Thank you. It's 18 words.
Yeah, 18 words per minute. Yeah.
It's pretty solid stuff, actually. How long could you keep that up for?
Oh, well, any messages were only usually short, so you didn't have long messages.
But, of course, training for Bomber Command and the exigencies of the service being a wireless operator in that respect brought a number of other factors into it, didn't they? I guess you had to translate from the business of being in the laboratory where you're learning on base to the instance of flying and flying under dangerous conditions. It'd be very different being a Morsi then, wouldn't it?
Yes, we used to have a training area about 300 feet under the aircraft.
Yep.
And of course at Parkes, many of the pilots got bored and they would dive bomb some of their people out in the stations. And if you didn't wind up the aerial quick enough, of course some of them lost their aerials. So yeah, we had many of them would lose their aerials because the pilots doing it day after day got bored of that. But anyway, I never lost my aerial, but there were times when they'd be banking and you'd be frozen. You couldn't continue with your message because the gravity would force you, more as paralysed. So they'd be asking you to keep sending and you couldn't send. So we had a lot of difficulties that way. But anyway, we managed to get through. Most of us got through the course. So, as I say, and went on to Port Pirie where we learnt to fire at drones behind the ferry battles towing these drones.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, so that was our training for gunneries.
And did the wireless operator then double as a gunner?
We were supposed to, but we were all wireless operators when we went to Port Pirie. Our course was all wireless operators, so we're all doing the same thing, or learning to fire either in the range, rifle range, or in the flying in the aircraft. Keane used to fly that, he drones and that sort of thing.
And then came your first posting. What was that, Norm?
Well, then we were sent to the showgrounds at Melbourne, and we finally were loaded, 23 of us were loaded onto a Blue Star line, which was a small 3,000 ton freighter that used to take meat between Britain and Argentina, but they had cabins on it, so we were four to a cabin, whereas it used to be just they used to take passengers and they'd only have 12, but there were 23 of us, and it was quite good. We were signed on to officers as ordinary citizens, not as Air Force, because they were a neutral ship.
Ah,
so
yes.
We were taken, as I say, across. We manned the guns on the ship, the Oricans, the old Oricans, and we were formed into groups, the 23 of us, to man the guns, and they had a 4-inch gun on the aft, down the back, and there was a team of 8 picked us to man that. And so that was our, we manned those guns. And on the way round Wilson Promissory, there was a very upheaval with the way the ship was rolling, and two of our chaps were airsick, and they were sitting on the deck on chairs, and a big beam came off the top of the openings, and used to close the top of the openings, and slid across on their knees. So these poor cows got their knees and everything grazed. So they were not airsick, but they were, I mean seasick, but they were, so that was, but after that, we had a fairly good experience going across, and we finally got to the Panama Canal. And that was a big experience for me, because I'd never seen green so much. Yes. In Australia it was grey, but here it was green as anything. All the islands and that coming down. Anyway, we went through the Panama Canal and stopped the night at one of the ports there before we went through. And we wandered around, but we didn't stay there long. And coming through, it was experience to go through to Panama for me. You know, sure. I'd never been outside Mildura.
Mildura with a very low rainfall, isn't it? And then that there is incredible.
Yes, and we used to see the, not the crocodiles, but their things that used to slide in the water.
The
like
alligator.
Alligators, used to see them on each side. But anyway, we enjoyed that. We couldn't see out better than, we were more or less on a holiday, and we got through the other side, and then on the other side we crept up the coast of America, and all the lights were on the city, and of course we'd see masts of ships all along that the subs had managed to pick off because of the lights. But anyway, we were lucky, we got through to New York, and we based just beside the Normandy, which was lying on the side at 42nd Street. So we had 10 days in New York while our ship must have hit a whale, which we didn't know, of course, and had to have a bit of damage done to it. So we had 10 days in New York, and we went to see the Empire State Building and things like that. And
you had any shows on Broadway?
Yes, we went to one show. In the not in the Broadway, but in the Stage Door Canteen, which was a canteen for the Americans.
Sure.
And Ray Gregory was a friend of mine. He was a beautiful pianist, and there was a photo of him and I and this starlet. I don't remember her name, but he played beautifully there. But that was our trip. But as a it was a huge experience to me. New York was a fairyland.
Exactly.
You know, all these huge buildings and that. So it was a real education to me to go through all these, a country boy. So,
don't forget your cup of tea, I'm interrupting you.
And then,
so let me just check on that. You had this upbringing in Mildura, sound family background, fruit block, salt of the earth sort of stuff. It was not easy to get a job. You couldn't get perhaps the apprentice training you wanted, and the Air Force offered a chance to learn a skill. Suddenly you found yourself, you'd crossed the Pacific, you were there, Panama Canal, you saw all these incredible sights, and you described New York as a fairyland.
Yes.
What a remarkable change to your existence.
It was a tremendous change for me. Yes, from a country boy that's never been out of Mildura. Yes, and these high buildings and things like that were astonishing to me. And anyway, we were made most welcome in New York.
Yep.
And as I say, we had quite a good time in New York. I was a bit disappointed in Times Square. I thought it would be more important than that, but it just seemed to be another street to me.
Exactly. Yes.
So I was a bit disappointed in that. But anyway, when we got to the other side, we crept up and got to New York. And then coming out of New York, we were then formed into a convoy of 40 ships that had to go from there. We were escorted by two little corvettes. Yep. That was all. And of course, that was a big experience because we had to try and get up there without. Every night we were attacked by subs, and they usually picked off the last egg, the last ship on the line. There were seven of us in lines, and we were in the middle, thank goodness. And often the little tiny ships would be picked off by these subs, and nobody was allowed to stop. All the ships had to keep going. And so a lot of them never were saved, because these two little corvettes were spent their time running up and down, trying to protect us. Well, we went like that for quite a few days, and then suddenly we were in fog, and we went suddenly a big battleship appeared out of nowhere, because we'd got lost, I think, and we must have been by Newfoundland. And that was our first indication we were lost, but this must have got directions from the big battleship. And from there we went over to Glasgow. There to me was an eye-opener, because a beautiful morning sunshine on the window, all different colours. There was a picturesque entrance to there. So that was, we landed at Glasgow and billeted for a night there.
Where have we got to in terms of the time, the period, the month, the year? When was this, by which time you got to Glasgow?
Well, I suppose it was probably nearly March by the time we got to
43. Okay. So you'd had a remarkable year and a bit in the Air Force. You got to Glasgow, you saw all this multicoloured light, the reflections. Yeah. March 43. What did you do next?
Well, then we were billeted a night there, and good meal. They gave us a nice meal, which all the way across the Pacific, and small ship that we were on, or boat, yeah, ship they call them, but we were well looked after. Mm-hmm. We had beautiful meals, as we treated as civilians, you know.
So, what was the name of the ship, you remember?
The Blue Star Line. It was the...
That's all right.
Blue Star Line. I just can't think of the name of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Anyway, it was a freighter on the old Argentine.
Yes, a freighter, yes. And they used to take about 12 passengers as well.
So you were looked after in Glasgow, and then you had your first posting, I suppose?
No, from there we were taken straight down to the bottom of England, to Bournemouth. Bournemouth was where Australians were quartered. We were quartered in an old hotel. And we had about a week there, and then we were given leave. And I went to up to a place right by Birmingham, and stayed with the family there for a week. Then we came back to Bournemouth, and we were posted eventually back to, in the Lakes District, a place called Milham.
Yep.
Which was Milham, and that was...
Spell that for me.
M-I-L-L-O-M.
Thank you, yes.
Milham, and near the Lakes District, and we had to do a month's training there, and... it was a pretty dreary place, pretty awful place, and the meals were shocking after what we'd been used to. But anyway, we had to do a course on the new wireless Marconi sets,
right,
which were after Australian sets. Our Australian sets were about 100 years behind, and these new ones, and I looked at them and I thought, how could one man watch all these different dials? But anyway, after a while, we gradually got to be able to do them and send messages, and we did a bit of a flying as well as in schoolwork. So we did a month there. Then from there, we were posted to Lichfield in the middle of England. And there we were Our first thing was, after a while, after a day or two, was to all gather at a big hangar, and we were to form up an air crew into different crews. And I was asked by the navigator, it turned out the navigator, if I'd like to be in their crew, and I said yes. So anyway, we had a nice pilot, and the others joined, as I say, we joined up as a crew there.
What squadron was that, Norm?
That was the Litchfield Training Squadron.
I see, Litchfield Training, okay. Yeah, and all nationalities in your crew?
Yes, we had two English and one South African.
Yeah.
And our first engineer was Australian, but something happened to him. I think he got sick, and so we had finished up having two Englishmen, one engineer and one rear gunner.
Right.
As part of our crew.
And what aircraft were these you were flying?
These were Wellingtons.
Wellingtons, right.
Yeah, Wellingtons. So we did our first training on Wellingtons, and while we were there, Bomber Harris came with us. He was on one of our training trips.
Right.
I never knew who he was, but he was quite nice and quite friendly and everything.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Well, what was your association with him? Was he commanding you in some respect?
No, well, he was over Bomber Command.
Yes,
he was. He was the Air Chief Marshal, and he happened to be at Litchfield at that time, and as I say, he went out with my pilot, Tom Orford, and as a second pilot.
Boy. Really?
Yeah, it's just, I think he just wanted the experience, I suppose.
Mm.
But anyway, that was quite a thing. And didn't seem to worry about us as far as impressing us or anything. It was quite natural. So,
while this was going on, if I just digress a moment, was this at the time that the Dan Buster Squadron was training over the
Rocks? No, this was before that.
Before that, yeah. Okay.
Yes, this was before that.
Yeah.
And we did so long there, training there, and then we were sent to a place called Blighton, and then we went on to Stirlings, trained on Stirlings, and did a fair bit of training there. Then we went on to another station, and we went on to Halifax's, and then finally we were posted to Binbrook.
Binbrook, yes.
Into 460 Squadron.
Yep.
And we went on to Lancasters.
Lancasters, yes. Okay, thank you. And you go into town and have a drink at the Marquis of Granby, was that right?
Well, I never used to drink.
You didn't?
No, I didn't drink. I was, most of the few I knocked around with, none of us, we all came from the country and we didn't, none of us drank. So we were all more or less non-drinkers, a whole lot of us. We were all fresh.
Yeah.
Of course, country boys.
That's all right. Now, it was a famous pub in Binbrook that they...
Never went to that.
So you were... Then you'd progressed through... Really, you've trained in a number of aircraft by this stage. You'd got to the Lancaster, and we're now, late 1943, I suppose?
Yes, it was getting towards August.
Right, okay, well into 43.
Yes, August.
And now you're actually training for action.
Yes, actually trained. We did quite a few trips. I had got to get used to a new, what they call G-set.
Right.
Which was a G-set a bit bigger than that. And that was marvellous for me for plotting where we were. There were three masts in England, and this would plot between where we were. And I got quite good at it, and I could always tell the part of their training runs whether we're over Norfolk Cathedral or almost exact.
Right.
It was so good. And that was my training on that. So, we started till we got ready for our first trip. We did quite a few training flights before we finally were ready for ops.
So the machine you were talking about before was the G...
It was called a G-box.
G-box. It's a bit bigger than a miniature tape recorder.
Yes.
And this enabled you to get a better fix.
Yes, accurate fix. Yes.
To establish position.
Yes, all over England, yes.
Now, did you have the same crew throughout this time then?
Yes, we had always the same one of us. a pilot would offer, the first when he first went on to each aircraft would always be the co-pilot. He always had a senior pilot with him, but after a while he would be the senior pilot.
What nationality was your pilot?
He was Australian, West Australian.
West Australian.
Yeah, marvellous pilot.
Was he?
Beautiful pilot.
What's his name?
Tom Alford.
Oh, O-R-A-L-F-O-R-D. Tom Alford.
Tom Alford, yeah.
Thank you.
He was a bit older, he was 25.
Yes.
Yeah, a bit older than us.
Yes.
And a very, very good pilot, you know, very good.
So your first trip occurred just after that?
Yes, we were on the squadron for quite a few weeks before we did our first trip. Base Manham Base, that was the first real op over Germany.
Right. So and that is, do I take the date from this left-hand side here?
Yes, that's right.
So that's 5th of September 43 over Mannheim.
Yes, yep. That's okay. Right, yes. And Base Munich Base.
Yep.
That's then local flying, that was training. Some of these, they took us off, as I say, when the jam buses were on. We were supposed to go there, but my pilot, he knew Gibson and didn't like him, and so he managed to waggle us off.
Yes.
So we didn't know anything about it, but he did. But he was, by then, he was a flying officer. He'd move me up the ranks.
Yes.
He was quite authoritative. So that's why we were doing these other. And then we went on to what they call as the H2S, which was a big bulge underneath the aircraft.
Oh, yes.
This was a new type of navigation aid, which used to send a beam down to the ground, pick up the shape of different... It was like that. You often see on television with the Navy. It's like a thing going round and round, an arrow going round and round, and would cover over the sheds or shape of towns, and that was the new stuff for flying, which was marvellous, really. So we were starting to use that.
But you were encountering, surely, a lot of flak all the time?
Oh, yes, every trip was... Yeah. Every trip was, you know, you see aircraft going down and all that sort of thing, and terrible lot of flak.
Yeah.
But you used to think you were... bulletproof.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be you, it was always the other fella.
Yeah.
That's the way I used to fly anyway. Yep. Always thought it was somebody else. You'd see planes going down, but and then terrific explosions when they hit the ground and all that. Yes. We were attacked several times, but we managed to get away, so we were pretty lucky, really. Yes, so. And then there's the next one is Bochum, you know, in the Ruhr.
Ruhr, yes.
Yeah. So that was that. So that was a few of the ops. And of course, Munich again, there's Munich again, Castle, Stuttgart.
Yes.
Hanover, local flying time. Just getting training there, base. Hanover, Leipzig.
Leipzig again, yeah. Right, okay. And that was 20th of the 10th, 43, Leipzig.
Yes.
It's a long way to fly.
Yes, well, we offered the trip by the time you got back, your eyes were out of here.
Yeah.
Because you had to keep a watch out all the time.
Yes,
for fighters. And also for the other aircraft, because... You were flying at night, and it was easy to crash into some of the others because sometimes there were 600 or 700
sure.
aircraft in a raid.
Yeah. December the 2nd.
That's right. That was our last trip when we went to Berlin and it shut down.
How many trips had you done by then?
Well, that was our 15th.
15th.
Yeah,
okay.
15th.
Can you talk me through that? What happened?
Well, when our pathfinders would drop flares, so you had to fly to guide us into the target, and we were lining up. The bomb aimer would get the pilot to hold us steady, so he could drop his bombs. He couldn't weave or anything like that. And we were dropped our bombs, and then straight away, because the bomb doors are so hard, take so long to close, they're slow, and they're pretty big, and the pilot had to hold us steady, and of course, then the Jaguar 88 and the Massif Richard moved in on us, and one of them fired cannons at us, and the first blast hit the mid-upper gunner and the two outer engines and set fire to them. He was killed straight away, unfortunately, but then we were burning so fiercely that I think the fighters decided we were gone, so they disappeared, and the pilot would then hold steady, and for a while they realised there was no hope, so he gave the order for us to bail out, and of course, as I say, I decided then that I had to go out the back.
Yep.
And the rear gunner, the mid-upper gunner, we all had to go out the back door. I got down to the back door and the rear gunner was waiting. And he was a bit terrified at that stage, jumping because the flames were coming so fast back. Anyway, I didn't hesitate. I opened the door and I jumped out. Got burnt a little bit across the face, but anyway, that's how I bailed out. And I never saw any of the crew again for months, for quite a while.
Now, you'd done your parachute training, though.
We had never done any training on parachute jumping.
So your one jump
my first.
Crikey. But had you been instructed how long you
were? Well, we had an idea what to do, yes. We were given an idea what had to pull the rib. But I fell for quite a few thousand feet before I pulled mine, because the fighters were still around, and I thought they might shoot us up, which they had done.
Yes.
Many, many times they'd shot fellas hanging in parachutes, so I dropped a fair way before I pulled the parachute. Then I swung there, I could hear the aircraft going back, and I felt sorry for myself, thinking I wasn't going back. It was such a big blow, really, a big experience, and then I thought, well, I'm going to land in the lake, and of course I thought, well, I'll have to release the parachute and swim. Anyway, all of a sudden I hit the ground, and that wasn't a lake, it was snow.
I see.
And so I quickly got rid of the parachute, tried to bury it, but the ground was that hard I couldn't, so I just stuffed it in a bit of a hole. And then in the distance I could see a car with headlights on, and I guess they must have been picking up some of the crew or one of the crew. So I diverted, and then I crept on, and after a while I was going through the ploughed fields, and I thought I would get into the forest because it was safety there, and I crashed through the forest because it was too hard to keep quiet. And my bomb aimer must have been hiding there, and unfortunately I didn't know it. And anyway, I passed through without contacting him, and I walked for a fair while, and then I used a compass, which was a little collar stud.
Yes.
But I found in the dark it was that hard to see. But I'd been travelling for quite a considerable time, probably more than an hour or so. I had sparks here, which was the signal of a wall, so I took them off
on your sleeve,
and I pushed them in the ground, and an hour later I could see the sparkle there in the ground, and I'd walked exactly in the circle.
Lord.
And exactly over the marks where these were. It's hard to believe.
It's incredible.
Yes.
This was your wireless operating
signal.
Wireless
operating. We had sparks there,
insignia.
Insignia. And this in the moonlight was.
So whereabouts were you? I mean, the raid was on Berlin.
Yes, well, we kept going straight past through, and so we must have been quite a few kilometres past Berlin before we bailed out. It's hard to know how far, but anyway, that's how we landed.
So you did this circle in the forest at night.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, this is no good. So I thought, I better wake up. So I forgot about the compass because it was too dark and to see in the night. So I went by the North Star.
Yep.
I knew that we knew we had to do stars in the our courses. So I knew the North Star, and so it was easy. So I followed my directions from them, gradually trying to work down southwest to France. I was hoping to get to. And so,
did you have any emergency rations or anything?
Yes, well, I used to fly with a bar of chocolate.
Yep.
And I had a couple of little maps, which were proved to be useless because there were towns here and a town there, but nothing between, so I could use those. And but I had a toothpaste full of milk, sort of condensed milk, and I had a couple of pills that were put in water to sterilise the water. Yep. But that was all I had, really, was what...
Very cold?
Yes, I was pretty cold. Yeah. And after the first... towards morning, I tried to lie down in under a fir tree, but it was too cold, so after a while... And then it was a railway just went past, and I thought, will I try and put a log on the railway? But after a while, I thought, no, it would be a bit risky because I couldn't get away quick enough.
Yeah.
So I gave that idea away. So I kept walking then, and of course, walked for a fair way. And then towards nightfall, I was still walking, and in the darkness, I thought I could see a soldier up ahead. So I thought, I'll duck. So I ducked into paddocks. And after a while, I had this feeling of uneasiness, so something was around me, and I thought the Germans. And of course, I fell down on the ground, and a light shone in front of me. And I thought, come on, get it over with. You know, I was that nervous. Anyway, nothing happened, so I quickly rolled away, around away, to get away from them. And it wasn't until later on that I discovered that it was a torch that I had. And I pressed the, through falling down, the torch had shone. Yeah. But I didn't work that out for a while. And of course, then I discovered after about 10 minutes or so, it was cattle that were all around me that gave me the uneasy feeling something was around me. Yeah. So anyway, I kept walking until that night I tried to sleep again. And then the next morning I got up pretty cold and miserable, and I drank water just out of little puddles on the road, and had a bit of chocolate and a bit of condensed milk. But then I was walking through these pine forests, which had a big gap between them, like they do in Australia. And this track went through, and I was walking along, and I could hear in the distance somebody following me. And I thought, I looked around, here was a soldier with a rifle, and I thought, well, when he gets up to me, I'll tackle him. Well, he walked past me, never said goodbye or hello or anything, and he was that intense on getting to where he wanted to go, so I let him go and let him in the distance. And I walked for miles then for quite a while, and eventually I came to this little village, and there was a big haystack there, and so I crept in the haystack and tried to sleep that night in the haystack, but gee, it was cold, I was frozen.
You'd been on the go?
Yeah, been on the
48
go.
48 hours?
Yeah, two days now, and then next morning I got up early, and the girl was delivering milk. And I made the big mistake. She gave me a wave, and I waved back. And I didn't, then, instead of pinching the milk, I should have pinched the milk. But I never thought of that. I was so keen to get away from the village. So I kept walking and walking and walking, and finally I came to a bridge I knew I had to cross because the river winds a lot. And there were guards on this river. And one guard, he had about seven people around him, and he was questioning them. And I just walked up calmly, slipped around behind him, kept walking and was so busy he never noticed me. So I got, then I got to the other side of the bridge, and way behind there was a chap, a guard just a bit further off the bridge on a gate. And I thought, gee, where's it? So I went down to the bridge and he looked as though he was going to challenge me. So I quickly dodged to the left into the forest, and by the time he got his rifle off his pack, which he was carrying, I was out of sight for him, and fortunately he got away. But then I came to a little village and walked through that village, and there were little kids following me, and anyway, after a while they lost interest in me, and there was a shop, just a little shop, that had a bread in the window, and I thought, will I bash the bread? Then after a while I thought, no, it's probably artificial bread, so I had to keep walking. And this was, by this time, as I say, I was going into the third day, and anyway, I came walking through this forest, and there were two or three houses, I thought, by the river where I knew I had to cross. And I walked past these houses. There was a chap cutting wood in the backyard of one of them, and he yelled out to me, and I just waved to him and called out, but I kept walking. But anyway, apparently he was a soldier off duty, and he quickly came out with a self-station dog and his revolver and that, and so I was captured. That was my first capture.
And you were in the... What sort of uniform did you have?
I used to wear overalls.
Yes, I wondered. Yeah.
I had overalls which covered me, which made me look more like a civilian. Yeah. But anyway, he took me into the... Turned out to be a school, and of course all the kids came out to see me and look at me, and then from there he questioned me, and then he took me to...
He spoke English?
He couldn't speak English, he tried to.
Yeah.
But then he took me to the headquarters where the soldiers were. Apparently it was a camp not far away, and he took me there, and then they questioned me. They at once could speak very good English, but anyway, I just gave him my rank, number and name. And after a while he gave in and put me in a sort of a half dungeon, you know, but you just see a bit of light where I live, but it was underneath their headquarters, and they barricaded me in there, and they gave me a meal, fortunately, which was the first meal I had, so it was quite good. But they were quite friendly to me, but then about a couple of hours later, suddenly they opened the door and took me out and put me in a car with soldiers, and I sat there for a fair while, then they took me out and put me back in. They must have thought, I had directions from somebody, they must have thought they were going to send me to, you know, because I was a spy or something.
Yeah.
But anyway,
but you had the uniform under the...
Yes, I had the uniform.
Under the overalls.
Yes. But anyway, they put me back in the dungeon, and I tried to get the window open, but I couldn't because it was all nailed, yep. So I wasn't able to escape there.
Still pretty cold? And
Yes, they did give me a bit of a bed and a blanket to sleep that night. But then the next morning they took me by car to another camp a fair while ago, and there they questioned me again. And they said, look, if you talk, we'll call a doctor, because I was a bit burnt across the face. And I said, yeah, I didn't say anything. I just stuck to my number record. So anyway, so I spent the night there. And the next morning, they marched me to a station, and we caught a train there, and with all the civilians in it, on their way to Berlin. And of course I had the soldiers and the officer guarding me, so the people didn't attack me, but there was a shocking destruction all along the roads in the in Berlin was shocking, and all I could see was all these team of men, there must have been Ruskies or somebody, marching with shovels and whatnot to clear up the rubbish. But anyway, they took me to Tempelhof Aerodrome in Berlin. I was questioned there, then put in a big underground place where there were plenty of palliasses. So I spent the night there with another chap, and we in the morning they took us out, put us on the train, and sent us on our way down to Dürrenluft, down to Dürrenluft, then down to
That's all right. Just pause for a moment. You'd been picked up. This questioning, it was by the military, wasn't the Gestapo.
No, it was always the military.
Okay. And then, so you were in this polling camp, should we call it? Okay. And in a sense, I guess you must have been really worried about civilian reprisals. People.
Yes. Well, fortunately, the guards were around me, so they kept me safe. So nobody made a move. So.
No.
But I did think they would take to me because they threw a lot of our airmen in the fires. Yeah, so I was a bit, I was certainly worried.
And this first POW camp you were sent to was Julia?
Well, it was. This was sent to Dürrenluft down
to
down to south.
Could you spell that for me, please?
Dürrenluft. Dürrenluft. Yes. I think it shows you in the in some of that map.
We'll have a look at the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Dürrenluft.
Yep.
And
that was the first POW camp.
That was not the POW camp. That was interrogation. That's where they interrogated the
interrogation center.
All the Air Force chaps. That was a special camp for them.
Right.
Yeah.
And now that's mentioned. You've got a book here by one of your fellow prisoners. I Flew, I Fell, I Survived by Thomas L. Fielder. And it's in there somewhere,
yes,
this reference.
Yeah. There is a reference to it somewhere.
We'll have a look at that and hear the similar experience to yours.
Yes. And I was in there much longer than he was.
Here we are at Dürrenluft, Dürrenluft. T. Okay. He was caught in. He entered there January 44, which is about the same time.
No, year. I was in December.
December, right, okay.
43.
Yes. Thank you for that. And this book has even got some photographs of the region. Okay, thank you. So you were interrogated at Dürrenluft.
Yes. I was placed in solitary confinement.
Yes.
And all you had was a straw mattress, you know, and plenty of bugs in it. You got bitten every night. And first of all, a Red Cross chap would come and interview you, and then he would give in. Then next you'd get a German officer come in, he'd interrogate you. Then you'd get a kind one would come in, always, and then a different one. And day after day, you had different ones come in to interview and always try to crack you, always try to trick you. And I was there, as I say, quite a few days before, and they only gave you just a bit of bread and a bit of soup. That was all you got. You got very little to eat there, and as I say, it was frightening experience, really, because you're on your own, you couldn't talk to anybody.
Were you tortured at all?
Big man.
Were you physically tortured?
No, just mentally tortured. Yes. They were artists at that, they were very clever. They'd frighten you. Then the next one will be kind to you. And
they promise you things.
Yes, all sorts of ways of trying to break you.
Yeah.
And
what did they want to know?
Oh, they wanted to know anything you could tell them.
Yeah.
They would question you where you came from, what you did, what bombs you did, what you...
Really?
anything. And of course, I think they had an idea with the navigator and myself that this new H2S, which was just new, I think they had an idea that I think they must have found the plane and wanted to question me on that. But also my navigator, I didn't know he was there,
right.
But he was there at the same time. But that was what they were after, just any information they could get.
And did they know you were a wireless op then?
Well, I didn't say they did. They don't tell you anything. Yeah. They just ask you. They don't say what they know.
Yes.
And anyway, one night, suddenly they took me out into the little parade ground they had, lined me up against the wall.
Right.
Four soldiers stood a fair way away from me against that wall with their rifles and this officer, and then they'd line me up and say, get ready to fire. And of course, I thought at that stage that this was it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, my mother and my father would never know what happened to me, because nobody would have known. Anyway, the bluff, after a while, they called the bluff off and took me back to my cabin. And next morning, I was taken before the head of the Secret Service there. And he questioned me again and said, who do you think I was? Air Chief Marshal or somebody? And he said, we know a fair bit all about all everything. And I didn't say anything. Anyway, he pushed things in front of me, and I looked at it. They knew every school in Australia that I knew of. They knew who was in charge.
Yeah.
They knew who was on our squadron. They knew everything. I couldn't have told them anything about who was. See, they must have got. I'd broken a lot of the fellows. And of course, it was an ordeal, mentally, to combat them, because they were artists at it and very, very good at it.
Please go on.
But anyway, then finally he ordered me out of the room. He was that wild at me.
Because you stuck the name rank.
Yeah, I just gave him my number and rank and that. But anyway, so I went back to the my room that night. And next morning, we were all paraded out, about, must have been 20 or so of us, all together, and that's where I met my navigator for the first time.
Yeah.
Yes. And then from there, we were taken to a little a place where a whole lot of other POWs were, and that's where we were billeted the night. And we were given a little bit of a Red Cross parcel, our first sign of, something reasonable to eat. So we had to share it with several others. But that was our first glimpse of freedom, more or less. So, we spent only a night there. Next morning they took us out and put us in cattle trucks on our way to Doolingcliffe, which was Frankfurt. That was Frankfurt on Main.
Yes.
And that was right down south. And we had to come up to where we were, Muhlberg, which was near Halle and Dresden.
Right.
And so we went by train in these cattle trucks. No toilets, no nothing, but they let us out every now and again just to a toilet just in the open for us. And we had nowhere to lie. We were all crowded in the thing, so we didn't get any sleep, none of us, in the thing. But then we went to Muhlberg. We were offloaded off the train at Muhlberg and marched to the camp. That was the camp there.
So this is the one I'm looking at now. Yeah. Muhlberg, Muhlberg. And that is Stammlager 4B.
4B, yes.
So first thing was to get deloused, I guess. Was that the
yes. They had a big room there where they deloused us, like a shower room. And then sent back to the billet, where we were, showed you some of the beds there and that. We were crowded in. There were three high and three long, two long, these billets.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So we were then about about 120 of us in one end of the camp of the hut, and there were 200 in the other. There was huts like that. They were all huts all through there, and we were in with army chaps really, because the Air Force had a special compound on their own, but we were overflow. They'd been full by then, so we were in this camp, this thing. So that's how I started my POW life.
Now, this was early 44 then. What rank had you attained by this
time? Well, I was a flight sergeant then.
Right, okay.
Yeah, you went promotion gradually, and I was a flight sergeant by that stage, yes.
Now, did that give you any privileges in the camp at all?
Well, sergeants and all those didn't go out to work parties, but army chaps, they all went out to work, but we weren't allowed to go out to work, being Air Force, because they thought we would escape.
Ah.
They were always frightened of the Air Force, so we never went out, but later on, some of them did go out. This chap, he went out on work parties, and I did go out on some of the work parties, but only to get wood, because we had briquette fires, and we never had enough wood or enough briquettes or anything in them to see. So we used to supplement. The Germans would take us out with soldiers and collect wood in the forest.
Yep.
And now you have one. I've had mine.
Okay, very good.
There you go.
This ban or this fear you'd escape, a bit pointless, because I understand you did try to escape in any case, didn't you?
Yes, I tried to escape with a navigator. We decided we'd try to escape after we'd been in a while. And it was night time, and we crept along the ground, and we got past the first lot of wires. There was two lots of wires. But unfortunately, we picked the wrong time, because a guard with an Alsatian dog just happened to be coming round. And of course, the Alsatian picked up the smell and they came and took us. So the two of us were taken to a prison, a special prison inside, and where you get only a wooden bed, no mattress or anything, and we were given bread and water. We interrogated, and so both of us spent 20-odd days in
20 days
in 21 days in that solitary confinement. So that was our first attempt at escape. But later on, Tom doesn't say there and that I was with him, but he was one of the we used to muck, because we were separate, brought together in this Air Force camp, and we used to muck together. And he became very interested in, found out, he tells you how he found out how this escape committee was operated. And they were, there was a hut right out like on its own in the compound away from ours, and it was used for educations, you know, teaching people all different educations. And they got permission to build up earth around the edges of the walls. And of course, this was just right for the escape committee, so they decided to dig a tunnel. And they went down through the floorboards and they were digging a tunnel, and he got me, he doesn't remember that, but he said, I didn't go, but the two of us, there were 49 of us all in the team of seven at a time, with the dragging the earth back. And we had two Welsh miners who were miners, and they would be at the pit. But as the tunnel got further and further, the oxygen became a big difficulty, and that, so somebody pinched a hose from the German's garden, and somebody made a bellows out of a kit bag and used to pump air to them down the front. Then somebody, one of the escape chaps, also pinched wiring from one of the huts and had electricity, so there was little lights all along to see, because it was so dark. So anyway, that's we dug there for quite a few weeks, and then that we got outside the perimeter of the camp, but by then the Germans had cut the grass, the hay or whatever it was, which made it hard for us to get out, so that whoever was in charge decided we'd go out much further. Well, unfortunately, in doing that, the Germans got suspicious. They'd found a Russian tunnel, so they were walking around, and they came around and they thought this looked funny under the hut, the earth, so they poked shovels and that and into the sea, and then a chap at the top, he was always a Canadian, and he was our watchdog, and he quietly warned us, the seven of us are in the tunnel, and we quickly climbed out underneath the thing on the other side and got away. But he was then taken and questioned. He spent quite a few time in prison, in solitary confinement. But the seven of us managed to get away, luckily, before they finally called the soldiers and discovered it was a tunnel. But then they filled the tunnel with sewage. All that work.
It had taken you weeks.
Yeah, it had taken us weeks to do it, as I say. But still, it might have saved our lives. Who knows? We might have got out, because later on, the Germans, with the escape, great escape,
yes,
they took us out on parade for a whole day. We stood in the parade. They warned us about this great escape, that we would be shot if we got away or not. So that was the end of that. But Tom, he went on to have another attempt at escape, because the committee was still working.
Yes.
And the idea was there used to be old one of these wagons that the oxen pulled, but to get our supplies from the Red Cross, that was always run between a channel of wires down further. So the job was these six would push this along. Two of them would make out something wrong with the wagon on a bend, and they cut the wire, open it up, and then two would step in French. By then the French were allowed to go out to work, you see. And they'd go out and fetch uniforms when the soldiers would walk the opposite way. So they got out quite a few that way. And Tom, in this book, he got out that way and spent about 8 days before he was captured. So that's
Tom Fielder.
Tom Fielder.
And was he the fellow who was your companion on that first escape attempt? The two.
No, that was the navigator on the first.
The navigator. What was his name?
Eric Daly.
D-A-L-E-Y?
Yes. He later became a doctor in Western Australia.
Right.
Yes.
When you had that attempt with Eric, did you have any supplies, civilian uniform, outfits, disguise, anything like that?
No, we didn't have any disguise. No. So we just hoped that we would get by. We had saved up chocolate and things like that.
Okay.
Yes, that's all we had. But we would have been struggling.
Yes.
Just the same.
So the tunnel was discovered. You didn't go back into the cooler after that episode.
No.
And we're well into 1944 by now. Then we had the Great Escape. You were warned that any escaping prisoners would be shot. And that pretty well put an end.
Well, it didn't to Tom and those. They still got out. And as I say here, quite a few of them got out. Another way they got out, I was sort of one of the workers on the escape committee. There were older chaps that were pretty clever. We just worked, told what we were to do. Our job was to push this wagon.
Yes.
Also, another one was to, every morning there would be a work party of army chaps have to go out to work. They'd be marched out. Well, some chaps had to, which Tom did, swap his uniform for army chap, and they'd wait beside the first gate, and when the officer would count them, then as soon as he went to move off, they would join the gang, And they got out quite a few chaps like that. But I was never one of those. You sort of took your turn, and my turn never came up. So until finally they woke up, something was going on that way, they stopped that too. So they stopped both ways of escaping.
So you stayed a prisoner, POW, from December 43, right through until what?
Right till when the Russians came through, and in April 23rd, I think it was.
Yes.
And by then we were out, didn't have Red Cross passes, we were pretty near starving at
that. I wondered how you survived all that time.
All that time was the Red Cross passes. We got them for a fair part of the time, not always, but one parcel was about 10 pounds in weight. I don't know how many kilograms, but 10 pounds in weight. And some of them came from Canada, some came from Scotland, some came from Australia, which we never got, but England too.
Yes.
Different parcels, different times. And we would get these parcels fairly regularly for quite a while, until the last 4 or 5 months, when the when the Americans and Russians were just about meeting, and of course the trains couldn't get through with these Red Cross parcels, so we then lived on just skilly and turnips.
Yes.
You know, the Germans had potato mounds. That was another thing when I was escaping. I couldn't understand why I was going up and down over these mounds. It was only later that I discovered in the camp that it was actually potatoes, and they mound them with straw and then dirt to keep them. Well, they had a lot beside their camp, and of course that's how we were fed, these awful potatoes, not good ones.
They're pretty bad. And what was that skilly?
Skilly was what they made soup out of, a bit of meat, perhaps of horse meat, or barley, or something was in with the turnips. That was our soup, which was pretty poor.
When you read about prison camps, you read about, as well as the escapes, as well as the hardship and the work details, you read about comradeship and entertainment and study and that sort of thing. There was no chance for that?
In the camp. There were some very clever men and good. And with the Red Cross parcels, they used to make backdrops for their stages. And so they had quite a few shows.
Yep.
And we would be entertained, about 3 or 4 shows which they put on, which were marvellous. Some chaps would be dressed up as women and that. And they were well done, marvellous shows. And we played cricket in the hot weather. And also they had soccer matches. So they did have some there. But one of the trouble with the cricket was one time one of them hit the ball into the vegetable garden where the Germans had. And the chap went in to get it, and there were strawberries there. And of course the guard was in the cabin just nearby, and he shot him straight away, so he was killed. So that was the first one shot in the camp that we know of. But also another thing was, we had commandos in the camp, and we never had enough briquettes, so we supplied so much briquettes. But he and his mate, they would, or two or three of them, would slip out at night, take a risk, terrible risk, because, lights would be all out on the thing, and they'd slip from hut to hut and get to this hut where all the briquettes were. And they'd done this for quite a few months before one of them was in the briquette, and the Germans opened the door and just shot him. But he was a marvellous man. Tom mentions him there. It was a shame. He did all that for everybody else but himself. So that was a big blow to everybody, lack of briquettes, because up till then we'd be getting briquettes for our particular hut.
Sure. You see, and it must appall you the way things are presented, you see in films and television programs the way the Germans are portrayed, and they're often portrayed as either very cruel or very stupid. The guards are often lampooned and made fun of. What were they actually like?
Well, we had one we called Snowshoes. He was pretty cruel. He would buy a bomb aimer, happened to walk on a bit of lawn when we would do our walk around. We all used, most of us used to walk. And he bashed him up, especially walking on the grass, because he didn't stick to the path. But he was noted for his cruelty to anybody.
Yeah.
Yes, but the rest of them weren't too bad, but the younger ones were the cruelest.
Really?
The younger officers.
Yeah.
But towards the end, we had Austrians. They took all the Germans out and we had Austrians, but Snowshoes stayed there. He was the senior NCO, but he was one of those arrogant Germans, you know, who hated everybody. So he had to be very careful with him.
And what about the Austrians? What were they like?
The Austrians were all right. They weren't too bad. But by then, of course, I think they lost interest in the war too. So
those last few months in the cold, the winter of 44-45, Red Cross parcels decreasing in number?
Well, they didn't have any towards the end.
None at all?
None at all. So we just lived on skilly and a bit of bread. They always used to have bread.
Did you have any news of anything? Did you have
yes. Well, we're particularly good because in the hut, these chaps always had a hut commander, and they had a wireless in our hut, and they used to holler out a broom, and they different ones would have a valve or something. As soon as we were searched, they would take these out and close the broom up. But every night, we used to have one chap would go round reading this news to us, so we really were well up with the BBC News. And they did that. They'd go from hut to hut, take terrible risk, but managed to do it.
So you knew, for example, about the Normandy landing?
Yes. And, of course, a lot of the British who had been in since Dunkirk, they got very disappointed when there was no move. And then when the second front came and it became a stalemate, they got very bitter, a lot of them. A lot of them got depression, I suppose you'd call it now, but never got out of their beds. We used to have to get up in the morning, be on parade outside and stand there while they counted us. And then at night again, always twice. Of course, they used to have to cover for these chaps that escaped. So often, while the officer was counting here, a chap would slip up to fill in another one there. So many a time the Germans, I don't think, discovered till too late that people were missing. But that's how it was done.
Sure.
And so really the news that we had in the centre of our hut was a chimney where the briquettes and everything were moved. They had a big map of the war front, and some chaps would pinpoint where the front was, and the Germans never took it away, and yet the little maps that we had when they searched our hut every now and again, the SS would come in, search the hut, and they'd take every little thing we had, but they never took away this big map with the thing there, which amazed us.
Did you have any news from home?
Not for a long while.
Yeah.
I had, eventually after months and months and months, I got little letters from my uncle in England, but I don't think I ever got one from home.
Did the family in Mildura know you were a prisoner?
Well, they must have known because I was notified about 3 months later.
Yes.
3 months after I'd been shot down that I was still alive.
I wondered how they knew, because you would have been missing an action first.
Well, I think the Red Cross notified them, sent them a telegram saying that I was still alive.
So we come now to April 45.
Yes, and then the Russians came by, mostly on horseback.
Right.
They were with their Tommy guns, and then we'd have a commander, and he would... then they made one of our... The only officers we had were the three padres. They made one of him in charge. Well, of course, nobody took any notice of him because he was a soldier. But he then we'd have another Russian that'd come, and then another one. They kept changing all the time. So more or less, they just, whoever been in the workplace before with food, were organising the food, fortunately. So they got stuck into all these potatoes near the camp and things like that, managed to get barley and that sort of thing. So we did start to get a bit of food, but then that wasn't enough for most of us. So we then started to roam, you know, roam out.
Oh, you could have to get out of the camp.
The camp was, by then the Russians, we had quite a few thousand Russians in the camp, and they were sent out to work every day. They used to empty the latrines and all that sort of thing, and they were starving.
Yes.
Well, as soon as these Russians came, they just fled, because Russians never regarded POWs. Nobody was a POW to them. They had to make their own way back. So they disappeared, and they raided all the close places, all the little towns nearby, and I was one of those appointed to police to stop them murdering people, and I was issued with a baton and that, but we were supposed to stop our fellows getting out of the camp, but we couldn't do that. So I wasn't a policeman for very long. But then Tom and I, we roamed the places, we got food by hook or a crook. You know, it was always hard to find food because the Russians had scourged everything, and our other fellows, everybody was scourging chooks and even cattle. Some of them killed cattle, pigs and things like that. So we'd come back to the camp every night and eat what we could, because a lot of chaps were sick because they tried to eat too much. Fortunately, Tom and I only get a bit at a time, but a lot of them were terribly sick through. And there was a 2-acre paddock of rhubarb right by the camp in their garden, and that was wiped out in about 2 or 3 days because people... and Tom, of course, was a pretty good inventor. He made a little machine for heating, like that, our jam tins. It was a picture of it, it's in there. He made them for others. He was always inventive. So we could cook whatever we had, we could cook on these little stoves.
It was a huge camp. What was the
I suppose there were about 30,000.
30,000?
Yes, there were Dutch, there were Danes, there were British, there were 2,000 South Africans who'd been captured, you know, in the Greece and
it's
that
enormous.
Place. There were a lot of Russians, of course.
30,000
prisoners.
So what happened when the Russians came in, and you had the snowshoes and you had the Austrian guards, what happened to them?
Well, snowshoes, of course, still stayed as the commander of the camp, but the Russian commanders would just be in charge for a little while, then they'd disappear, because they worked in waves of three.
Yep.
There were the Cossacks, and then the next lot, and then the tanks. Yeah, so they all worked as three different divisions coming through, so you had different commandos each time, you know.
So you must have been hoping for the Americans or the Canadians.
Yes, we were, and we did get a jeep of American come, but then he disappeared. So we were all disappointed because we thought he would organise us back to the American lines, but by then the British and the Americans had stopped a fair way short of us, and the Russians were coming through, and they came through past us onto the American lines. The Americans had agreed with the Yalta Conference that everything, when the German was collapsing, that the Russians would be having a certain line and the Americans and the British a line. So that and of course the Americans stuck to their line, but the Russians didn't. Right. They pushed further and further in. So they were well past us. We were under Russian control, really.
So how were you liberated? What happened?
Well, we just were liberated, set free ourselves, just to roam the place, which we did for a month.
So you roamed the countryside for a month?
Yeah, getting food and things like that. And anyway, then all of a sudden the Russians decided to round everybody up, which they did. and put them in a cab near where Risa was, a big cab. And Tom and I and several others didn't like this. We were a bit suspicious. Yes. So we decided that we broke out of that cab straight away before the...
That was Risa, R-I-S-E, isn't it?
R-I-E-I-S, Risa, Risa. I think the name's in that.
The hook, yep.
Yeah, R-E-S-I-A-A.
Yep.
And, so we broke out of that cab and we walked for many miles, five of us, and eventually we knew where Russians, where the British were, I mean the Americans were, and we had to crawl over a bridge that was broken down. One of the over bridges here, that was the one.
Oh, yes, I've got a picture here over the old Risa, R-I-E-S-A. There we are. Yep.
Yeah.
This is Soviet occupied East Germany. Yeah. You needed to get out of that.
Yes, that's right. So we crawled over, got over that bridge,
yep.
And then it was near the dividing of two rivers,
yep.
The Elbe and another, and the Americans were on in the middle, and the Russians were on this side. And of course the Russians didn't stop us, they let us go across. So the Americans were waiting, iron bolts were coming through at that stage.
Yeah.
And so they had a truck just up the road on the other side of the river and directed us to that. And there we were picked up in the truck and taken to Halle,
yep.
Where a big hospital centre, and then given food, and it was a hospital centre, and given food and looked after there for about a week, I think.
So you spent about a month roaming the countryside,
yeah,
near the camp.
Yes, camp.
And then you just had to fend for yourselves.
Yes.
Taken to the Russian-controlled camp.
Yes.
Didn't like that.
Didn't like
that. Got out of that in a hurry. Crossed from the Soviet-occupied zone via the bridge into the American zone.
Yes, into the American zone.
Yes.
And the Americans looked after us for a week. And then we were flown by the Americans to Brussels. In Brussels, we stopped the night there and looked after by the British. And the British then flew us in Lancaster back to England.
Right.
Where we were denounced and questioned and all that sort of thing.
New uniforms, that sort of stuff?
Well, we didn't get them there, but we got denounced and we spent a night there. And then we put on the train and sent down back to Brighton, down on the coast there, given new outfits and everything.
Yes.
Yeah, so...
Well, the transformation...
From different...
Yeah.
Yes.
Your mood, your sentiment must have been...
Yes, yeah, it was all adventure to me. I never got terribly frightened at any stage, whereas Tom did. He said he got terribly frightened, but I didn't. I was that different type of person to him, I think. I was always the optimist, so I thought I'd get there, or do this, or do that. Whereas Tom was a pessimist. Yeah. He was a different man, different type to me.
And then came the time for repatriation to Australia?
Well, we were at Brighton for quite a fair while. We were given leave after a while. I went and visited my uncle, and also visited these people up in... right up in the Walsall, where they'd looked after
Walsall near Birmingham, yep.
I visited them and my uncle, as I say, and and then time came for us to be shipped back to Australia. We were shipped back in the big ship, 7,000-ton ship, a whole lot of us. And we had bunks, hammocks underneath the... different decks. That's how we were transferred to Australia. On our way back to Australia, the war ended with Japan.
Right.
That was August the 15th. We were on our way back to Australia then. Then from there we went back to Australia. We were given a marvellous welcome. We landed in Sydney, went from Sydney to Melbourne. Melbourne gave us a marvellous welcome. My mother and elder sister came down and met me there, and then we were taken from there down to a place called Warburton.
Oh, yes.
Warburton, and that was a chalet to try and build us up a bit. Yep. So we had a fortnight there, and then from there they sent us back to Melbourne. We were discharged and back to Mildura.
Yes, I was just looking at your service record, and here we are. Discharged December 1945, in the rank of warrant officer.
Yes, that's right.
Good, yeah. Okay, so you got made up.
Yes, well, I made it up.
Well done. Just out in time for Christmas.
Yes, yes.
And on the train back to Mildura, what did
on
you do?
On the train back to Mildura, yes.
Right.
And then back to civilian life.
Yes, well, was that difficult?
Yes, it was, because I had no trade, no nothing. And by that time my father sold the block because he didn't have enough labour, because my younger brother joined up too.
Yep.
And I didn't have a job, so anyway, a friend of mine there in Mildura, his uncle was a blockie, and so he wanted a labourer, so I got a job for him for 18 months to work for him. It was almost like slave labour.
Yes.
He was that tight, you know. He was a man that expected you to work 24 hours a day, I think. And so I put up with him for 18 months. Then I was a bit frightened to leave him before that, because I'd applied for a soldier settlement block, which they decided they were allocate. So I didn't want to muck him up in case he gave a bad report. But anyway, after 18 months, then I was notified by the sort of settlement to do an 8 weeks course at Dookie College. So I went and did that Dookie College course. I was then offered at Dookie College a lecturer's course, and they wanted me to stay there, because they had at that stage, no lecturers in agriculture, in dried fruits. It was more dairy farms and all around Dookie. And so I was offered that, but I didn't. I went back to Mildura, worked for 3 weeks for two brothers who are marvellous. They wanted me to work for them, but my cousins down at Coolwa, they had property there, and they wanted me to work for them, so I did. I said I'd work there. And I worked there for 6 months and enjoyed it really well.
What sort of work was this?
It was just, they had sheep and they had apricots, they had oranges, they had everything, a mixture. And I was more or less helped them in all that sort of work, because labourers were short of supply then, they couldn't get me. So I worked for them for 6 months, and I got notified that I was allocated a block at Romville. And so I said goodbye to them, and then Easter 1947, up I went to Romville, and they lived in. We lived in huts for quite nearly a year. You know, we had to clear land, and we cleared land a primitive way with axes and whatnot for quite a while, until finally some of the senior ones who, in the first allocation, they'd talked the sort of settlement into using a bulldozer and that sort of thing. So we had bulldozers and chainsaws to cut the bow saws, actually, saws on a big belt, cutting the trees, and that's how we cleared. Well, I didn't get allocated. I got allocated the block, but I didn't get a chance to go on the block till the next year, because they ran out of time, and four of us had to wait another year clearing, helping the next allocation. So that's how I started my career on the block, planting vines and trellising and all that sort of thing.
So what were you, sultanas? Or what
yeah, you I had 10 acres of sultanas and 4 acres of, 11 acres of sultanas and 3 acres of citrus, and I had 4 acres of gordos. And the gordos, we dried all those, and the oranges, of course, takes up about 8 years before you get enough to sell. So that's what I did.
Forgive my ignorance there. I know a bit about the area, but gordos, are they...?
Gordos were dried those lexias, they called them, and dried and sent to England.
Oh, yes.
And so we had very good and bad years, wet years, and then the floods came in 56.
Right.
And, of course, we had to down tools, and the whole of us used to have to fight to surround our petrol, our pumping plant, which right. was down on the edge of the river. So we spent many a week there building levee banks, high levee banks and whatnot there. And then also the levee banks, and the river broke it towards Euston, so we, which was just over the road from Robinvale, so we went over the road fort there and built levee banks there, but we didn't save it, it broke away over there. So it was 20 miles across the 56 floods there, Lord, just yes. at Euston.
You got married, son?
Yes, I got married. I met Betty in the end of 47
yes.
and married in the end of 48.
Right.
48, yes. And we lived in a hut for the first 18 months or yes. so, before they built a house for us. And then they built a house, so she had to rough it for a fair while. Yeah, she was a city girl, so
it was, she?
So a big, big thing for her.
And you and Betty ran the fruit block at, yeah. where was it exactly?
At Robinvale.
Robinvale. How long did you run that for?
31 years.
31 years.
Yes. Yes, until I retired to here. We happened to be, Betty always knew Normanville. They had, sister had a holiday home there. We used to stay there on Christmas holidays, and we came over looking for somebody always to retire to eventually, and we saw this block of land and nobody wanted it, and so we put a bid, we got it those days, we got it pretty cheap, and so we've got an acre and a quarter here.
Well, we're sitting on top of a hill just on the edge of Victor Harbour looking out at the sea.
That's right, yeah.
Great view.
Yes.
You see the whales?
Yes, that's right. We can't from here, no. But it's grown tremendously.
Yes.
When we first came here, there was hardly any houses there, sure. none on the top. That was all bare, and none all around here. But it's grown tremendously since we came.
I guess the last thing I'd like to explore with you is the great bonds. I mean, this great friendship with Mr. Fielder, who wrote this book, Memoir of the Days in the Camp. The former POWs. You went to reunions?
No, I haven't been to many reunions because up at Robinvale, we were away from most of the reunions which they had. So I have met some of them, but not many.
Right.
So really, I haven't been to reunions.
And you're in the Caterpillar Club?
Yes.
Too, because you jumped out with a parachute.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yes, I've still got the caterpillar there. No?
Yes.
Yes. But I suppose there's not many of those left either now.
No. I guess the final area, really, you know, there you were in the fruit block and you learnt the trade and you finished out up as a blockie for a long, long time.
Yeah.
The military experience clearly changed your life.
Oh, yes, it was opener to me. I would never have got as far as I have now.
Really?
Yes, I think it was a big, big opening because I grew up in the Depression where it was jobs were hard to get and wages were hard to get. It was a pretty tough time for everybody. Everybody was the same around where I was. So this Air Force really changed my life altogether. And I've never got to where I am today.
So what did it give you? And what did being a prisoner of war give you in terms of character and outlook on life?
Well, I think the strength of mind was the main thing. If you were strong, you didn't give in. And I think that came from my father. I think he was that type, and he brought us up, father and mother. They were very strict Methodists.
Yes.
And very, although he went through a lot of disappointments with failures and different things like that, he stuck it out. I think we grew up as kids, we had to take milk to school and sell it on the way, and eggs and butter and asparagus. We used to grow a lot of asparagus and sell that as kids. So we grew up hard, hard as kids that had to battle. So I think that was the good grounding that I had.
And he was Lawrence, L-A-W-R-E-N-C.
Yes, Laurie.
And Laurie, your mother's name?
Laurie, L-P-G-I-N-G-I-W-N. Yes.
And your mother's name was?
Daisy. Yeah.
Daisy, lovely name. Okay.
She was her parents were the original settlers at Warrnambool. Yes.
Where?
Warrnambool.
Oh yeah, Warrnambool.
That's funny to think that my daughter finished up there. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so original. There's been a book written about the Midgleys and that from Warrnambool, and she was like her father was one of the ones that came out.
So the Air Force changed you and seeing the Panama Canal and New York and all that stuff.
Yes.
But being a prisoner of war, that must have given you something, this remarkable resilience that you seem to display.
Well, I suppose it was, you had to be to last the distance, yes. I think, yes, to me it was, you know, I was always the optimist that I would get through.
Good on you.
I never felt as though it was the end.